Welcome. I'm Josh. This is Dharmapunks Tuesday night gathering. September 1st, Labor Day, we'll be doing our annual retreat at Garrison Institute. The info is now, I believe, on the Garrison website. I haven't yet actually put the sign up info on our website. I'll do that shortly. So for those of you that would like to sign up, we will be having in Philadelphia, I believe, a day-long retreat on June 15th, Germantown Unitarian Center. Find out all the information on dharmapunks with an xnyc.com. Yeah, so if you'd like to support my work as a Buddhist pastor and counselor, everything I do entirely supported just by donations. So the donations are dharmapunks with an X, NYC and Venmo, or you can go on the website for PayPal or the Patreon. With that, I'm going to be talking tonight on appreciation. Why it's so difficult to have gratitude as a regular practice in our life, how important it is, and then some of the Buddhist practices that allow us to essentially sustain that state of mind, which is so very beneficial. I guess I'll just start by noting that if you are over 30 years of age, then you have something to be very grateful for, because much of human history, people died from violence, illness, malnutrition well before they reached 30. And if you're like me and you've actually bypassed a half a century a while ago and you're still going, then you really have achieved something quite extraordinary in terms of human history. If you're in relatively good health, then you have a resource that's not available to millions upon millions of people. People who have chronic, debilitating, degenerative illnesses and severe health threats. If you earned more than $14,000 last year, then you received more than 40 million people in the US who live below the poverty line. If you live in a democratic country with any kind of ability to vote, then you're in a rarefied group throughout history. In fact, right now, only roughly half of the world lives under something even remotely that could be considered a democratic system. And many of those are not even sham exercises. I will say that positive psychologists show that appreciation and gratitude allows us not only to strengthen our bonds, but it regulates our nervous system. And in regulating our nervous system down from the sympathetic threat detection, constant state of mobilization, that gratitude, reflecting with appreciation of all of our benefits, has the uncanny ability just to, as if you want to read Barbara Fredrickson's Love 2.0, it's filled with wonderful clinical studies that just show how it switches us from sympathetic to parasympathetic. And it's such a useful tool. It also is a state that allows us to broaden and build when we experience joy, gratitude, appreciation. It improves our sleep, our mood, our immune systems develop more white blood cells. It decreases depression, diminishes anxiety. And frankly, as the Mayo Clinic noted, that if gratitude were a pill or appreciation were a pill, everyone would take it. Even if that pill cost an extraordinary amount of money, given the benefits, but because it's something other than a pill, this incredible resource to human well-being is profoundly underutilized. We do tend to take our health for granted and only notice its gifts when it's taken away from us by injury, illness, or age. So we only really notice a lot of our benefits when it takes away, when it's taken away. We frankly can forget about all of the people who are available to express kindness and just focus on the one person that's not returning our text messages or our phone calls. We'll talk about why in a second. But we fixate on disappointments and resentments, frustrations, despite conclusive evidence that negative rumination is associated with higher blood pressure, insomnia, sleep disorders, digestive disorders, accelerated aging, heart disease, anxiety, and depression. And if you'd like to get a refresher on all this, don't believe anything I say. I'll check out the Johns and Hopkins papers on it, or there was a paper by Curran, Sims, and Marcus called Just How Bad Negative Affect Is. Despite all the benefits of a practice of reflecting with any form of appreciation or acknowledgement, acknowledging what we have, it's kind of paradoxical that we don't. It seems like we always need to find something to worry about, and that reflecting on areas in our life where there is abundance is somehow indulgent. And it was funny that even at times when things are pretty bad, people even seem to want to make it worse. One of the most bizarre things I noted was that during the beginning of the pandemic, which I would count as a fairly threatening, stressful time, people would, as a daily practice, rather than reflecting on the fact that they were still healthy, they would go on and doom scroll on Google, on their browser, and look for reasons to be even more anxious, which is extraordinary given the amount. If you're amidst a pandemic, the one thing you would want is your immune system to be healthy. But when people doom scroll and reflect on catastrophizing outcomes, it actually leads to the upregulation of cortisol, which impairs our immune systems. But that's an aside. So one reason why it's so difficult to practice gratitude, appreciation, to acknowledge our resources is, of course, the obvious answer: negativity bias. The evolutionarily, I think that's a word, I hope it's a word, ingrained tendency to focus and dwell on negative stimuli rather than reflect on positive reflections. We tend to remember painful events better than we recall positive events. We recall, and these are all clinical studies that document this, we recall insults with more accuracy than we recall words of praise that have been issued to us. Negative stimuli elicits a stronger reaction in the midbrain than positive events. It takes longer, far longer, to embed a positive memory than a negative one. And negative images elicit higher anterior cingulate cortex activation, and that's the part of the brain that focuses attention. Also, the anterior cingulate cortex is attuned to monitor disturbances in our social bonds, so we're far more likely to bring our attention back again and again to reflections or fears of interpersonal disturbances then reflect on all the people that actually are available who would pick up the phone or would be willing to talk. Why do we have negativity bias? Well, our ancestors were exposed to a great amount of environmental threats that such as predators, famine, disease. So being more attentive to negative stimuli would have helped us survive. The vast bulk of our history, we lived in extremely dangerous environments. So our amygdalas, our sort of threat detection systems of our brain became increasingly influential. And in fact, the amygdala over time gets the first glimpse at all incoming information. Hence, the oversecretion now of cortisol and adrenaline, our hyperactive hypothalamus, amygdala axis, and so on. Plus, the stress hormone that keeps us in a threat detection state, cortisol, is very addictive as well. So while gratitude practice is associated with higher levels of the feel-good hormone oxytocin, when we are in an active state of loneliness, sadness, disappointment, anxiety, shock, then it's far more tempting to, as a last-ditch effort, seek after something that's addictive and pleasurable, like food or TV binging or shopping on Amazon. All of these secrete dopamine. So over time, much of our life can be spent ping-ponging between stress, anxiety, or depression, which are cortisol-heavy states and are harmful, or the mood-destabilizing, addictive quests for constant dopamine secretion. Appreciation by comparison activates very low levels of dopamine. It does, over time, raise our serotonin levels. It does lead to a boost of oxytocin. But these states, while exceedingly healthy and beneficial, have nowhere near the stickiness of the cortisol or dopamine, our anxiety, our depressed states, or our that produce cortisol or the dopaminergic quests. So also, it's not just negativity bias. Our social conditioning makes us believe that upwards comparisons, like always paying attention to those who we believe are doing better than us, is, we're told, it's inspiring. On the other hand, downward comparisons, we seem to believe, are unseemly, a kind of gloating. Yet many studies, such as social comparison orientation by Gibbons, show that our tendencies to make upward comparisons result in feelings of inadequacy, inaccurate self-evaluations. And the reason why, the more time we spend on social media, the more negative affects we experience, is because when we're on social media, people are generally only posting positive images of themselves on a beach, at a party, living their highest sense of self. So it ingrains or instills or engenders FOMO. In fact, social media kind of is a gigantic practice of FOMO, fear of missing out. Contrastingly, when we are experiencing a mild states of sadness or loneliness or what have you, comparing ourselves with others less fortunate enhances our subjective well-being. If you look up the research called Downward Comparison Principles. So And it's not gloating. It's if you reflect that others are doing are not doing as well as we are, it's actually been associated with acts of kindness and generosity. So when people downward reflect, we tend to feel a greater sense of a very healthy state of gratitude. We're more motivated to do acts of generosity, which make us feel even better. When we make upwards comparisons, we feel worse about ourselves. We feel inadequate. We no longer have accurate self-appraisal, and we fear we're missing out on life's good things. So you make the choice on who you want to compare yourself with. And of course, there's the issue of entitlement. Entitlement, 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 which is the sense we deserve everything we have and therefore shouldn't be grateful. A classic example of entitlement is believing the food that we purchase from a supermarket and bring home is the fruit of our labors. And not reflecting on the fact, well, it's actually the labor involved was the unseen farmers and that planted and the farmhands that probably picked the food, the truck drivers that drove the food to our local market, the produce clerks who took it out of the crates and puts it on the shelves. If we once in a while reflected before we took any meal just how many unseen people contributed to us being able to eat, we would have entirely more beneficial states of mind. So the frame of mind, I'm fortunate to have this, fosters a beneficial sense of connection with the world, creates an upregulation of serotonin from the sense of I'm being taken care of. All these other people have contributed to allow there to be a road that I drive on, or allowed me to have a bicycle, or allowed me to eat food. On the other hand, if the story we live in is I deserve everything I have, that it's all due to me, it diminishes our sense of connection, our sense of being taken care of, and it actually fosters a greater sense of anxiety that someone's going to take away something from us. Our culture is a breeding ground of entitlement. We've become so animated about our individual rights and getting ahead that we spend very little time reflecting on the profound web of social responsibilities and care that actually are the real most important factor in our lives. I should say it's worth noting being appreciative or being appreciative is different from feeling appreciative. Yeah, that's right. Being appreciative is different from feeling appreciative. We don't really have much control over our emotions. They're non-volitional, they're pre-conscious reactions to stimuli. So we can't will ourselves into being appreciative, but we can practice actions that actually cultivate a state of being appreciative. And this is what brings me to the absolute crux of tonight's talk, which is noting the difference between decisions versus practices. So, practices are routines we embed into the rhythms of our life. And over time, over the course of weeks and months, they eventually link a region of our brain, the striatum, especially a very small region called the ventral tegmental, to the which initiates an impulse to do something, and that links to the basal ganglia, which initiates muscle movements or actions, and also to the frontal lobe, which initiates thoughts and reflections. Through sheer repetition, we ingrain these circuits or routines. If we do it the same time of day, the same place, they eventually become automatically activated by the ventral tegmental, which is also responsible for the secretion of dopamine. This is key. If we do any kind of appreciation or gratitude practice every day, the same time writing it out, just sitting in a meditation practice for a minute and reflecting on whatever it is right now we feel we have in abundance or we feel provides us with a possibility for happiness, we do it like an exercise, the same time, the same day. Eventually, our brains will want to do it automatically, just like the other routines that over time we wouldn't do unless we had developed a striatal routine. You know, people literally wake up very often, go have through the same routines of showering or feeding themselves, making coffee, different times of day, going to the gym at a certain time, et cetera, et cetera. Routines are vastly, vastly motivating. On the other hand, decisions or choices are very, very fragile cognitive practices or processes. It's great when you're under no stress whatsoever. Then you probably could decide to do a moment of reflections of all that you're benefiting from, all the people, all of the good fortune that you have experienced in your life. But suppose there's any cortisol present, then your prefrontal cortex top-down cognitive function switches from being able to have any gratitude, any peace of mind, any ability to think about what's healthy in the long term, and it'll switch the control of your behaviors to bottom-up, fight, flight, intrusive anxiety-related thoughts. Stress deactivates the very region of the brain that allows us to make smart decisions. So, our only hope, if we want to be able to practice any kind of generosity, gratitude, goodwill, kindness, appreciative reflections, is not to wait until we're in the foxhole and the bullets are flying all around us, or we're feeling lonely, socially rejected, disappointed, frustrated. Our only hope is to instill a practice where every day we automatically initiate those routines. And at that point, those striatal circuits will come to our rescue. There's also what's called mood congruence. Our thoughts invariably align with our underlying affect state. So if you're anxious due to mood congruence, you're going to have worrying thoughts. If you're angry, if you feel under attack, or if you feel an underlying state of aggression, then you're going to have thoughts of anger. If you have underlying states of confusion or overwhelm, then you're going to have an array of thoughts that are going to cloud and going to become overwhelming and are not going to provide any way forward. So, waiting, hoping we can find the bright side when we're lonely, angry, depressed, in shock, or confusion, if we don't have already ingrained a practice, it's simply not going to happen. A daily practice of reflecting on those who've shown kindness engages our dorsolateral, our frontopolar prefrontal cortex, which overrides intrusive, repetitive, stressful thoughts. And again, it's responsible over time for antidepressant serotonin upregulation synaptically. So why wouldn't we want to do it? In Buddhist teachings, gratitude, appreciation is known as kettanu, and it literally means to remember what has been done. It starts with a positive reflection. And in Buddhist practice, daily practices of gratitude, kaganusati and kalyanamitta, reflection of friends or people in our life, are foundations, the Buddha teaches, of skillful qualities. In fact, the Buddha taught that a person of no integrity is a person who is ungrateful, who doesn't reflect or appreciate everything they have in their life that's of any spiritual value. And the Buddha noted as well that peace of mind rests on what's called ekagata and vikara, which is the ability to bring our attention back again and again, unhooking it from catastrophizing negative thoughts to a reflection that's beneficial. And generosity is always at the top of his list as thoughts that allow us to detach from anxiety, assuming we've already developed it as an ongoing practice. Even if we can't think of anyone specifically right in a certain state to be grateful for, we can practice what in Buddhism is known as the refuges. We reflect on any spiritual figure. It could be the Buddha, but it could be any individual, someone who lived, or someone who's perhaps a spiritual figure that may or may not have lived, that sets an example for compassion, care, interest. For many people, it could be the sense of a ongoing deva in Buddhism, which is the presence of a divine spirit that somehow looks over us with kindness. Then there's dharmanusati, which is reflecting on any the vast amount of spiritual teachings that are available. It could be the Dharma, or it could be the spiritual teachings of another spiritual path that you feel kinship towards. And then there's sanghanusati, being grateful for the fact that there are spiritual communities out there, not just on Zoom, but spiritual communities pretty much everywhere we can go and connect with spiritual communities such as other spiritual faiths, 12-step groups, support groups, and on. So we're going to be doing in our meditation some basic anusati or gratitude reflections for people. And then finally, I'd like to note that the Buddha notes that there are what's called sublime attitudes or heart practices called Brahma viharas that no matter what we're experiencing, align us towards peace of mind. Therefore, and the one is metta, a welcoming demeanor towards all external stimuli and internal states, just rather than being defensive, guarded, suspicious, just cultivating an interested, curious, welcoming demeanor to our experience. There's compassion for suffering. There's equanimity for understanding the limits of our compassion and our spiritual practice, being okay with the fact that we as human beings have limitations. And there's finally mudita. It's actually third on the list, but for this talk, I'm making it the final Brahma Vihara. I should say that compassion, by the way, is karuna. But the mudita is the practice of appreciative joy for the happiness that others are experiencing. Now, we're not talking about the happiness that unskillful beings, people who commit murder or theft or aggression, experience. Sympathetic appreciative joy or mudita is happiness for others, joy or well-being that are the result of skillful actions. That's the way it's defined. So it's feeling good for others. Skillfully earned joy or well-being. And it cuts against our materialist zero-sum mindset that there's only so many resources to go around. Now, when it comes to material resources, money, resources from the earth, that's true. There is only so much to go around. Very often in childhood, siblings have to fight for the attention of their caregivers because there's only so much attention their caregivers can provide. But there's unlimited happiness available. In other words, if you look or reflect hard enough, you can think of someone who's experiencing some degree of uplift because of something spiritually sound or just hard work that they deserve. And it's an old spiritual adage that if you can experience mudita, your chances of happiness go up by 8 billion, at the very least, because there's 8 billion other people on the planet. So if we limit our happiness to simply things that have been good for us, then our chance for happiness is clearly a fraction of our chance for happiness if we're willing to reflect on the and feel empathetic joy for the happiness that someone else we know is experiencing. And by the way, if you count dogs and cats, then our ha chances for happiness go up by 9 billion. So there you go. So for a mudita practice, what we do is we bring to mind someone who's experiencing a hard-won success, peace of mind, joy, connection, and holding them in mind, we might say a phrase like, "May your happiness and good fortune not leave you. May your happiness not diminish. May your joy continue," any phrase that feels right for you. And so with that, I'm going to spare my voice for the moment and actually lead us on a meditation where we develop or practice a appreciation state. And hopefully, this might, if you experience the mood benefits of it, then hopefully it will encourage you to do this even for the briefest of durations every day. So find a really comfortable seated position that feels really good for you. It can be lying down, seated upright, standing. There's four postures: standing, sitting, walking, lying down. Whichever works for you at this time. And you want to close your eyes if you feel comfortable doing that. That allows us to bring our attention within and be less distracted by stimuli surrounding us. And this is a reflection practice, so it's not about external sensations. So dropping your attention into through the top of your head into your head, and just notice the sensations associated with your forehead, your eyes, your mouth, your jaw, any other areas of the head, especially the front of the head. And see if you can take a moment, if you'd like, to just squinch them all and then relax, or just see if there's anything you can, any slight tension you could release. And then bring your awareness down into your throat. See if you'd like to relax, release any tightness either in the front or the back of the throat, or even where the neck meets the back of your head. Continuing to the shoulders, I like to rotate my shoulders, lifting it up, and then rotate back and dropping them so that I open up my chest, creating a lot of space for the breath, space for the rib cage to expand and contract. Bringing the awareness into the palms of the hands and just seeing if you can fill them with awareness and then release any tension. Just allow them to relax. And bringing your awareness to the belly. Try to, with each in-breath, allow the belly to expand as full as possible without placing too much effort in. Just allow the belly to expand comfortably and then feel the energy move up to your chest. And then as you breathe out, just allow your entire torso, abdomen to release. So the out breath is a experience of fully letting go, releasing. And then if you're seated or lying down, just allow the full weight of your body to collapse into whatever's supporting you, whether it's a chair, a couch, a bed. Release any need to tense those areas. Just allow yourself to all your weight to be supported by the ground. And finally, for this practice, just tensing all the muscles down your legs, your calves, to your feet, squinching your toes, And just as you breathe out, just release, let go. And for the next period, just bring your awareness to your body breathing, if that's something that you're comfortable with, and try to cultivate an in-breath that feels energizing, and then an out-breath that feels soothing, calming. The in-breath keeping us awake and alert, the out-breath relaxing, removing us from any state of threat detection. So the in-breath and out-breath for this practice are as long as without any straining, really expanding the belly and chest with the in-breath, and then not pushing out the exhalation, just releasing. And for those who don't feel comfortable working with the breath as an anchor, that's okay. Then just be available for the sounds that are arriving. Without any image in your mind of what's creating the sounds, just hear your environment at this moment, like a strange kind of music of the present moment, distant cars or people. And for a little while, we'll just practice staying present. And every time our thoughts wander from the breath or from sounds, just bring it back. Give yourself a nice, rewarding sense of acknowledgement that the practice really is furthered not by staying endlessly present, but actually by all the times we wake up to the fact we've gotten lost in thought, and we, without any judgment or frustration, bring our attention back. That's really where the benefits of the practice lies, that remembering when we're caught in a thought or a memory, and just bringing us back to the present moment where chances are, if you're meditating, nothing bad is going on at this present moment. So at this point, we're going to do practices of appreciation, mudita. So bring to mind anyone you've encountered that exemplifies or has exemplified kindness, care, interest, attention towards you. And this practice can go back as far as you want. See if you can really visualize someone who at some point exhibited all the attributes that we aspire to: care, concern, or appreciation. And this is not so much a verbal right now, but just if you can visualize someone. If you can't, then just in your thoughts, repeat their name, the name of someone who was caring. How they saw the parts of you, the entire parts of you, but especially saw in you a core deservingness for happiness and joy and recognition. And then bring to mind all the unseen people whose work has allowed us to flourish, or those perhaps forgotten, the teachers that took their time to pay attention and care for us when we were young. It's easy to remember the teachers we didn't like, but cultivate a memory of someone who expressed kindness. And then also bring to mind an image representing all the people whose labor we've never even seen, the people who've a representation of those who've harvested our food. Who've brought our food to us, even during the pandemic, were willing to drive and bring food to markets, and those who worked in markets and kept food available for us, as well as people who work in providing health care. Who would be available if we needed it? You'd like to put a hand on your heart center, activating that parasympathetic sensation of warmth. Bringing to mind all of the spiritual teachers who've preceded us that have tried to share the wisdom that would simply bring about well-being and peace of mind. An image representing the Buddha or any other spiritual figure. Figures who selflessly, without seeking any monetary reward, spent their lives trying to make others' lives better. And lastly, for practice of mudita, bring to mind someone who is experiencing hard-won benefits for their patience, their endeavors, someone who's recovered from or in recovery from an illness, or someone who has been waiting a long time for a career or relationship breakthrough, or is receiving deserved recognition, knowing that none of this comes at our expense. And that if we can cultivate appreciative, empathetic joy, then our well-being improves as well. And it's okay that there's a desire to feel good, peaceful, what the Buddha called chanda, skillful yearning for inner peace. So bring to mind someone who's benefiting right now, not through ill-earned gains or poor behaviors, but through real, patient, sustained endeavor. And that's why if you can visualize them, just recite in your mind something like, may your good fortune continue. May your happiness and well-being not diminish. May you enjoy all that you've brought to bear. And now, whenever you're ready, you can allow this practice to subside and bring your awareness back to the screen. I'm grateful for your practice as well as showing up.